Join my friends, Jeremy and Kelly, with their combined background in DNA, journalism, and law, as they share tales of injustice and intrigue with a focus on true crimes along the banks of the Mississippi. So sit back, grab a glass of sweet tea, and welcome to Riverside Homicide.
Welcome back to another episode of Riverside Homicide. Here locally, the weather has been
miserable.
It's been cloudy and rainy and disgusting, yeah. And I'm over it. I hate the fact that it gets dark so early, and I cannot wait for spring.
Yes. Well, thank you for filling us in on the weather. Womp, womp. On a brighter note, though, why don't we talk about something that we didn't get a chance to mention in the last podcast. You recently had the opportunity to travel to Denver, Colorado to attend the Denver Crime Lab.
And I thought, to attend the Crime Lab.
Hmm? You know what I mean. Anyway, why don't you just tell us about it, your experience, what you learned, highlights.
I went to an investigative genetic genealogy training course that was hosted there on site at the Denver Crime Lab, which was really neat. We were, you know, in the conference room, what have you, but turned out that it was the like the CSI lab of Denver. So it was super modern and had got to take a tour of it. And, you know, they had the ballistics, they had the room, they had a glass panel window you could look through and see all the guns that they had collected over the years, the sampling, so they can compare bullets and all that stuff I don't know anything about. And then they had, DNA, fingerprint area. They had chemistry. I'm trying to think what that is now. But anyway, they had just all the stuff that you see on TV show. There was a garage where if they had a vehicle that they would, the tent over and do all the dust and looking for, evidence and stuff.
That's
so it was
very cool.
It really resonated with me because I've been binge watching the original CSI show. I'm season 11 right now.
Oh.
So it just coincidentally, this is just like the TV show. And but
who,
anyway.
Who was like the crowd of people there? Like what group? Did you have to have a law enforcement background or like who was there?
No, the members of law enforcement would come into the class and, talk about different topics. One that I was really interested in was CODIS. The guy that runs CODIS in that department was explaining how it was it's a state-specific database. So I always thought
it's not national.
Yeah, I always thought you run it through CODIS and you can see, this guy's a bad guy in Florida. Well, that's not the case. It's state-specific and, states that have nearby border states. So like where we live, Tennessee, Arkansas, Mississippi, if a crime's committed in Tennessee, in the Memphis area, they might have to collaborate with Arkansas or Mississippi to see if the DNA maybe is found there, if it's not found in Tennessee. So that was really interesting as far as the crime aspect of the law enforcement. But the class itself was on genetic genealogy, which is used in the past 3-4 years, especially to identify John Does, Jane Does, Baby Does, as well as bad guys. So rapists and murderers, where they leave their DNA behind. The first thing that police do, if they have enough DNA, is they put it in CODIS to see if this person's had a record before. But if it's not in CODIS, then who does the DNA belong to? And what the modern police agencies are doing is using genetic genealogy. So they were teaching us how to either work directly with law enforcement or work with an organization like the DNA Doe Project to assist in identifying who this mystery DNA belongs to. So it's a lot of Excel, a lot of charts,
fun.
And organizing data and analyzing data. But it was, I enjoyed it a lot, and hopefully it'll lead to other opportunities. I've already been contacted just last week to assist on a case. So as that progresses, maybe I'll be able to talk more about it.
Wow. That's super cool. It sounds like it was a useful, neat experience.
Yeah,
so I'm glad you got to go. That's cool.
I'm pretty passionate about ever since the beginning of the pandemic, when I helped somebody figure out who their biological father was using DNA. So I was like, ooh, what else can I do? And it's just something I'm really interested in.
Yeah, that's great. And on another note, the podcast that we did, our last episode about Catherine Lowry and Elizabeth Eisel, Shortly after we recorded the podcast, we received more documentation from the police, correct?
Yeah, in Washington.
Yeah.
And so, that was probably the most eye-opening
graphic
report that we've received so far.
And so we got a lot more of that. We also were able to, we got a lot of feedback from listeners, and also we were able to speak to more family members.
Yeah. Stephen's daughters reached out to us. And we had a nice 2-3 hour conversation with them. And then
super nice girls.
Then Catherine, who's the missing person from the Olive Branch area, her daughter actually reached out. Mm-hmm. So we might be able to put some more information out there on this case, mm-hmm. because it seems like more information is falling
maybe
in our laps.
Maybe have an update at some point soon on that.
So stay tuned for that.
Well, why don't we go ahead and get into today's podcast. This case I'd never heard of. Our dad actually brought it to our attention. It was a crime that he remembered when he was a child. It was the 1965 shooting of Evelyn Montese.
And Montese is a name that if you're from the Memphis, Tennessee area, you're going to be familiar with for a variety of reasons. Probably the most, well, at least from our generation, is because there's an attorney that has a commercial on TV.
It's easy with Montese. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love lawyer jingles. Just as a side note, I don't know if you knew that about me.
I do know that you're good with all kinds of jingles.
I love jingles. What a great way to remember stuff. Yeah. I mean, fantastic.
What's the other, Corby Trotz?
Corey B. Trotz is the way to go. Call 6737-0000. I mean, I'm going to be in great shape if ever I need a lawyer, because I know who to call.
What's the national one? The Morgan & Morgan.
Sorry. Yeah, Morgan & Morgan.
Morganpeople.com.
Yeah, I mean, we're set up. So anyway.
See, there's a law firm in Memphis called Gaddy, Keltner, Bienvenue, and Montese. Mm-hmm. And the Montese there is, you know, he's all over the billboards and radio and such. So that's how I'm familiar with the name.
Yeah, so when I first heard the name, that's the first thing I thought of. I was like, oh, I wonder if they're
related
connected
somehow. Probably are somehow.
Probably, I don't know. That'd be interesting if they were. I do know that Evelyn did have a son named Louis F. Montese Jr., who later went on to become a Tennessee judge. So there is some type of law in their background. So maybe
so. They're probably cousins of some sort.
If not, this episode is brought to you by It's Easy with Montese and Poncho's Cheese Dip. So hint, hint.
So let's talk about Evelyn a little bit. Obviously, this is an older case, so there's not a ton of information out there on the internet about her, because she was born in June of 1913. And at the time of her death, she was 52. And she was married to a man who was 5 years younger than her.
Okay.
So she was the elder of the two.
She was a cougar.
You didn't want me to say
it. I don't love that word, but it's okay. It is what she was.
She's from Memphis. Her father was a butcher, according to the 1950 census. And she met her future husband, Louis Montese, while she worked as a clerk at the Liberty Cash grocery store. And she was known by, they got married. I guess we should talk about that. They got married in 1937. They went on to have a family. They had 5 kids, 3 daughters, 2 sons. They also had another daughter that died.
So 6
at
birth. Kids.
Yeah, 6 kids, I guess. She was known by her friends and family to love a good game of bridge.
Which I know is a card game, but I know nothing else about it.
I know nothing about it either. It's like an old people.
I don't know. I feel like it's a very 60s thing. Like, I remember watching old movies and they'd be like, we're going to have a bridge night and stuff. I'm like, I don't know.
I don't know anything about it.
I feel like I need to learn. I don't know. I'm not a big card fan.
You do
but
knit. And
I guess I need to learn bridge. I'm not sure. Well, if anybody,
you don't even play Rook. We play Rook at our house and our family.
I will tear it up at Uno, like draw 4 all day long. You know, but
bridge, not so much. Yeah. Well, we'll have to. We'll table that, see what it's all about.
We'll do some further research.
If anybody knows how to play bridge, let us know. So her husband, Louis Montese, was the son of Fred Montese. And Fred was the founder of this supermarket chain all throughout Memphis called Montese's. And our dad told us that this was a grocery store. It's kind of a specialty grocery store. kind of like a Whole Foods today. And, you know, you could get buy all kinds of stuff there. And it was a chain of 29 stores. So it was a well-established name throughout the city of Memphis.
I would have loved to have known what they... I love grocery stores. That's another fun fact about me. I would have loved to have known...
Fascinating.
Lawyer jingles and grocery stores. It's party time over here.
While you're knitting.
I would have loved to have known what kind of grocery store it was. I think that would have been neat back in the day to see what kind of special...
I do enjoy Whole Foods.
Yeah, it would have been cool. It's cool that they had that here. Basically, though, back to the Montezis. I'm assuming because of all this that they were probably pretty well off financially.
I would think so. They had almost 30 grocery stores in the chain there. Very much a family business. At one point, all of Fred's sons were involved in the family grocery store business. The Commercial Pill, which is the local paper here in Memphis, stated that they lived in a, quote, stylish home in East Memphis. And at the time of her death, she and her husband, Louis, had just gotten back from a vacation in the Bahamas. So that sounds like they were well off. I mean, we looked up stats on the house. Mm-hmm. So the house, it was brand new.
Yeah, they'd only lived there for about a year. At the time of her crime,
it's almost over 7,000 square feet house.
Yeah.
Had it's a mother-in-law wing.
A little over 2 acres of land.
Yeah, it's in a affluent area of Memphis.
For those local, it's near like the Laurelwood area. It's a nice part of town. It was a cool kind of like Japanese style home with the roof.
Did I say that right? Architecture.
Architectural. I don't know what you're trying to say. I don't know. But yeah, so kind of that's the area it was. It was at the time, especially, it was like sort of an affluent
it's like,
part of town. Gosh.
We can't talk today.
We can't say words today, but that's okay.
But it's like worth $2 million now almost. It's like
I think is interesting because it is a murder house. And so it's still worth quite a bit of money.
And it needs some TLC based on the
photos.
The Google Earth photos. I still want to drive by there and look at
paint.
It again.
You need some paint. It's a little TLC.
Yeah. So let's talk about the crime itself. We know it happened 1965?
Right. So it starts on November 2nd, 1965. The Montezi family is just having a little get together at their house. Several family members are there. So Evelyn and Louis are there. I think Louis, one of Louis's brothers and his sister-in-law and some of their kids were there. And Louis's mom, which you said her name was Carmela. So she was there. They were just watching TV. Carmela said they were watching Red Skelton because he made them laugh. So they're just having a nice evening.
What's Red Skelton?
Did you say skeleton?
What did you say?
It's Red Skelton.
Skelton.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is.
Well, I don't really know what he is either, but I'm going to make fun of you for calling him skeleton.
That's what I thought you said.
I think he's either actor or comedian or something.
Oh, okay. This is not a name of the program. It's a person?
Yes, it's a human being. Oh.
Fail.
Anyway, so they're watching TV. And so the occupants of the house, so the people that live in the home itself is Evelyn, Louis, Louis's mom, Carmela, and then Evelyn and Louis's 16-year-old daughter, Vicky. So that's who lives in the house. But everybody leaves, the extended family, they leave a little before 9 p.m. Carmela, she lived in an separate apartment that was attached to the house. So she went to bed. She told police that around 8:55, she left the group, went to her room, and she was going to go to bed. And it was around 9:50 p.m. that things really got crazy in the household.
So about an hour after she went to bed, stuff starts happening.
Yeah.
So Miss Carmela said that she heard her son, Louis, yell, "Mama, mama, somebody shot my wife, and now he's following me. He's going to kill me. He cut me." And then Louis broke down her door to her bedroom because it was locked. And then she went to go wake up the granddaughter, Vicky. And Carmela says she didn't hear any gunshots or any sounds of fighting, that the only thing that woke her up was her son breaking down the door.
I think that's almost seems...
Maybe she's a deep sleeper.
Maybe. That's the only thing I can think of. She must have been a really deep sleeper because, you know, we looked at the house and it seems impossible that she wouldn't have heard a gunshot because the Commercial Appeal reported that there were neighbors across the street that heard a gunshot. So I don't know how somebody within the house wouldn't have been able to hear anything.
And then what about Vicky? the daughter.
Well, Vicky told the commercial appeal that she'd gone on a date that evening. She got home around 8:45 p.m. She said when she got home, everything was very peaceful. I read an account that Louis was she said Louis was asleep in the den. What did you read? You said
that he had been drinking a lot and
fell asleep. Okay, so he's asleep. And she said that her mother was working a crossword puzzle. Vicky says she went to bed around 9:15 p.m., but she didn't go to sleep right away. She was just in her room. She hears a lot of noise in the house. She hears things breaking. She hears her mother scream, "Don't kill me, don't kill me." And then she said her mother yelled for Vicky to come help her. But Vicky did not leave her room. I guess she didn't want to leave. I don't know. Maybe she was scared. She doesn't call the police. She calls her boyfriend. She tells him to come over. And the next thing Vicky hears is her grandmother yelling for her. So she then leaves the room, and that's when she sees the mayhem in the house.
Mm. It is weird that she called her boyfriend first. I guess she's 16.
Yeah, she's a kid. She was scared.
But, man, there was blood found all over the house, in the den. There was a trail in the front entrance hall. There was blood found on the near the stairs. So it looked like, you know, I guess when she was shot, she must have been moving around the house. Maybe, I don't know, walking, crawling.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But there was a trail of blood that indicated that, you know, she was, I guess, trying to get away from the bad guy. She ended up being found outside of the house in the grass.
Like outside of the patio area. Yeah. She was laying outside on the grass. Sorry, I am a little tongue-tied. But yeah, I agree with you. It's interesting, you know, that they found it in so many parts of the house. Like she was trying to get away. Police also found 6 .32 caliber cartridges. One was spent, 5 were unspent at the entrance of the house. And they also said that the living room furniture was just in disarray. Furniture was knocked over. So it looked like there'd been a scuffle, there'd been a fight. Vicky said that once she came downstairs, her father came running in from outside, which I guess that's where her mother was, and said that a man had shot her mother and he told her to call the police, which she then did.
Okay, so let's talk about time frame here. People left the house around nine.
Vicky gets home
around 8:45, so 15 minutes before that. Vicky goes to bed around 9:15. And all of this occurs just shortly thereafter because Vicky called the police, and then a neighbor called the police. The neighbor, Miss Siegel, called. And the police showed up really fast, right?
There was already a police car in the area, so the police documentation says that I guess that they received notice around 9:40, like our call somewhere around 9:40, and they arrived 5 minutes later at 9:45.
And so, during this time, really fast. Louis, he went to the neighbor's house. That's why the neighbor called. He was in his pajamas. He told her that he'd been robbed, and he showed injuries on his back, I think the back of his head. And then the police showed up.
Yeah. And they were watching Louis. Like, as soon as they got there, they had him under surveillance. And
well, yeah, typically, obviously, they probably thought it was a domestic incident. They ended up taking him to police headquarters for questioning around 12:45 in the morning.
I think it's crazy they got there so fast. I feel like that's kind of all.
Awesome. I think they said that the neighbor called around 9:40 to report.
So they were nearby.
And they were there by 9:45. So
everything went. It's crazy that, you know, they're having a quiet dinner, good time, happy time with the family, watching TV, not watching Red Skeleton.
I thought it was a movie. I didn't know it was a person.
But, you know, things sound okay. And then everything just goes so south in like 30 minutes, 30, 45 minutes.
But let's pause here. You have much more of an old soul than I do. I'm older than you by 10 years, but you know things about the 60s and 70s that I know nothing about.
Yeah, I like more of that kind of stuff.
I don't know. I don't know how that happened.
I've definitely seen Red Skeleton in something. I'm definitely I'm Googling him as we speak.
Kelly knows all about the Beatles, and like I knew nothing. I don't know. My parents listened to it, but I was dedicated to my 80s, I guess.
Yeah, that's okay. We can't all be as cool as me.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
So she was shot in the chest, once in the chest and a right lung. And I think it said that even part of her hand or finger was severed by virtue of the bullet going through it. So she must have covered her heart as she was shot. And when the medics arrived, she was still alive, but she couldn't speak. So she couldn't tell them what happened. Her husband, however, had several injuries. He had a cut on the back of his head. He had a puncture wound on his forehead, and he had scratches on the right side of his neck. So when they take him to police headquarters, they test his hands for trace of gunpowder, and it comes back negative.
But they were doing, like they said back then, it was called a paraffin test. And so that's a wax. So I know they're not doing that nowadays to test for gunpowder. So maybe the trial reports I read later on said that those paraffin tests were kind of unreliable. So who knows, like, if he actually did have any on him or not. But when they tested him, they said that's what they decided. The standard back then. They're like, okay, he doesn't have any. And he denied any involvement right from the beginning. He told the police a story. He said, well, earlier on in this evening, I got a weird call. I guess he was saying it was like a crank call where somebody, you know, he picked up the phone.
Prank call?
I don't know. They called him and they say Louis Montesi, and then they just hung up. So I guess he thought that was odd. Maybe he was trying to say, oh, hey, somebody, I don't know. Maybe he was trying to think that somebody was trying to see if he was in the house or not. He told the police, I didn't shoot Evelyn, but I do have a gun in the house, which he then gave to the police immediately. And there's a little conflicting reports on this as well. The Commercial Appeal came out with a story like 2 days after the murder. And the Commercial Appeal said, oh, it matches. His gun matched the bullet. But if you read the
court records,
it says that a ballistics test was done and that they did not match the murder weapon. The gun and the murder weapon were not the same. So he's just sticking with his story. He's saying that there was an assailant, a robber, that came in and did this. But that story changed over time.
And how did it change?
Well, his official story was that he went to bed around 9 p.m. after his family had left. That Evelyn came in, changed into her PJs, said, I'm going to read the newspaper. I'm going to stay up and go hang out in the den for a little while. So he goes, all right. And he says, I'm starting to read the paper, too, when I hear the doorbell ring. He says, then he heard Evelyn scream, robbers, robbers. And so he goes out. He says, when I reached her, she was lying on the floor. There was a man standing over her. And he said that then he was attacked by this intruder and that he tried to fight him off. He did this by throwing an ashtray at him. And that's how he's explaining away his injuries. He said he got it in this fight with the intruder. And he said at first he could not identify the man, but then that changed as well.
Yeah, that's right. There was I think I read an article that said that he thought he recognized the voice of the intruder. And he said it belonged to someone named Donald Bersacola, who was someone that was familiar to the family. He was 31 years old from Boston, Massachusetts. He was a traveling salesman and he sold shopping carts. I guess must have had some interactions with the grocery store business and shopping carts. Makes sense. And we don't know how long they knew each other and what capacity, but Vicky, their daughter, stated in the Commercial Pill article that he had been over to their house before, maybe 3 or 4 months in September of 65, and that it led to some problems, that Louis had gone to bed early one night and Evelyn was left alone with Donald. Now, I don't know what problems or what allegedly happened, but apparently that caused some friction between her parents. The next day, there was an altercation where Louis hit Evelyn and accused Donald of stealing money from him. She said that he threatened to hit Vicky if she intervened on her mom's behalf. And Vicky said that it was pretty typical that her parents would fight, and that her father was often violent. He would strike them. Mm. So
sounds like he was like accusing her of doing something.
He went to bed and left.
I know. I don't know.
But he was known to be an alcoholic. So. Yeah.
And Vicky, his daughter didn't speak highly of him. There was a quote from his brother in the appeal where he was making him sound like a pretty bad guy. So his family didn't have.
Well, he has this criminal record, yes, too.
So his background is interesting. So he was first arrested on August 31st, 1942, writing bad checks. He's fined for drunk driving in 56. He received a disorderly conduct charge in March of 62. Arrested again in April of 62, again for disorderly conduct and for making obscene calls. I don't know who to. In 62 was a bad year for him. In 62, again, he's got problems with drunk driving, had to pay fines. But to me, the most interesting thing happened to him in 1963. So a lawsuit was filed against him in connection with the suicide of a woman named Margaret Rodell Lancaster. And she'd committed suicide by jumping off the Memphis, Arkansas bridge the year previous in June of 1962. So in 63, her son filed a suit against Louis Montesi for $30,000, basically blaming him for her suicide. He said that Montesi had maintained Mrs. Lancaster for a long period of time at some apartments on Poplar, and that Montesi was aware of her state of mind, but he was negligent in preventing her suicide attempt. So I guess this lady was his mistress, and her son blames Montesi for her death. But the ruling ultimately was found in Montesi's favor. He wasn't held accountable for her death. So again, this lawsuit was in 1963. Lancaster's suicide was in 62. He had all those disorderly conduct, drunk driving, all this stuff happened in 62. So all this stuff happened.
Kind of spiraling, yeah, in terms of his...
Right, his life. And then Evelyn's murder is in 1965. So he had a lot of bad stuff leading up to her death in 65.
I looked up a little bit about this woman's suicide. She was a widow, so she wasn't married at the time that I guess she was allegedly having a fling with Montesi, who was married. She was 38 years old. She had a son that was 22, and he's the one that went on to file a lawsuit. But she left a suicide note in her apartment that said, "Mama, I'm sorry. Everything I have is yours and Tommy's." And there was a witness that saw her just pull up, immediately get out of the car, and not hesitate. She just jumped right off the bridge. It's just interesting.
That's so sad.
But, you know, he's tied up with her somehow, some capacity. And then he's got this background of criminal activity. The fraudulent checks and the DUIs and all that stuff. But, and then his own daughter is quoted saying that he's violent. So the police were suspicious of him right away.
He sounds like a little bit of a shady guy.
But going back to Donald, the man that Louis Montesi accused of killing his wife, the police did find him in Memphis at a hotel that was about 4 minutes from the house. So it was the hotel called the Admiral Benbow Inn. Can't make that up. On Summer Avenue. So again, just 4 minutes away from the house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Apparently, they found him around 5 in the morning. They brought him in for questioning 4.5 hours later, but they released him. He was not given a test for gunpowder, and fingerprints weren't taken. He told the police that he was in town for a business trip. He checked into the hotel late that afternoon on November 2nd, and his alibi was that generally he was just chilling in his hotel room, that he did step out to go find some fried chicken, and he called his wife around 10:10 in the evening, and then he made a much longer phone call to his mistress after that.
Oh,
I think nice. I think he spoke to his wife for about 3 minutes, and then the mistress phone call was like 20.
Oh, well, I would have liked to have known how he's a traveling salesman. I would have liked to have known how Louis Montesi knew he was in town. I didn't really think about that. Like, how did he know? It's not like they were like best friends or anything. How did he know he was in town? He wasn't from Memphis, and he checked in that day, November 2nd, which is the day
she died.
Maybe
they had a meeting to discuss shopping carts.
It's just an interesting question.
Because he was already there visiting 3-4 months prior.
Right.
To that.
You know, he blamed it on Bersicola, but how did he know he was going to be in town? Anyway, so it's not the strongest alibi that Donald Bersicola has. You know, he's, like you said, he's only 4 minutes away from the crime scene. He did know both of them. You know, he said he'd called his wife and his mistress, but those phone calls took place after the murder. So it doesn't, I mean, I don't know what his motive would have been, but none of that like looks good for him. And it didn't get much better.
Buy enough shopping carts for me.
Shouldn't joke about that. It didn't get much better because several days later, There was a property owner whose backyard adjoined the motel where Bersicola was staying, and he found a box of bullet cartridges in his backyard near the fence. And of course, these cartridges apparently were the same kind found at the Montesi's house. So that's interesting.
The same kind. I wonder if, like, there's comparisons that they could tell.
Right. But I mean, did they have those kind of tests back then? I don't really know. I mean, and it's all circumstantial, but still, like, you look at it and you're like, oh, that doesn't look very good.
Yeah, it definitely has some question marks. I wonder why they didn't do a gunpowder test on him.
I don't know. And I don't know why they didn't take fingerprints at the crime scene. I think that's weird. And again, it came up in the court record that those paraffin tests were not super reliable. So I don't know why they didn't do them. I think it's strange. I think the police just kind of zeroed in on Louis. They were probably aware of some of his, you know, criminal activities or his charges in the past. And they just seemed to zone in on him. And it didn't help the fact that, you know, his daughter claimed that he was violent and that he, you know, hit people in the family. And the biggest thing, though, that they talked a lot about in the trial was the scratches that were on him.
Yeah, the police said that the fingernails on Evelyn's left hand were dirty. They said that they weren't able to determine that the material was skin under her nails. You have to remember, this is the 60s, so they don't have the same technology that we do today.
But no, they didn't. They did know it was skin, but they couldn't tell, like, whose skin it was.
Well, that's what it says right there in the paper. Okay. Yeah, you're right. I just can't read. The skin was never identifying as belonging to Louis, but there was also not enough blood under her nails to compare to his. But the fact that he had scratches on the right side of his neck was used as evidence against him that they had been in a fight. And that was the most incriminating piece of evidence against him. So it was her left hand.
Right. On the right side of his neck. How would that work?
Let's see. Left hand. Right. I don't know how that. That's your left. That's my left. You can't see this.
This is terrible. We're trying to interact. Who's scratching the other person's neck?
Yeah, I guess that would. That would work.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it would make sense.
Everyone can do.
Try that.
Yeah.
Fun activity.
Yeah. Find a partner. Pretend to scratch them.
That evidence wasn't great against him, and his trial. You know, his trial was just strange. He voluntarily gave the police the gun in his house, but the ballistics test proved that it didn't match. And then the police weren't able to find the murder weapon. I don't know where it was. So if Louis did do it, where did the gun go in that brief 20, 30 minutes, you know, where he's running to the neighbors and what happened to it? Where is the murder weapon? I think that's really strange. You know, anyway, back to what I was saying, you know, his daughter claimed he was violent. He and Evelyn would fight. Yet on the flip side, they just come home from this nice vacation in the Bahamas.
Maybe they had a bad time. Maybe something.
She said it was relaxed in the home, that they were watching TV. Just weird. But then he has these scratches. She's got this skin under her nails. They can't test the skin. You know, at the trial, they present an alternate theory that maybe this Donald Bersicola guy did it. Somebody that Louis and Evelyn knew and who they maybe had a fight over before. He was close by, 4 minutes away. He has a flimsy alibi. They never test him for gunpowder. But what on earth could his motive been for killing Evelyn? I can't think of one, you know. So it's just
confusing. Telling you, they didn't buy enough grocery cards.
Oh gosh, I hope that's not it. It's confusing.
Maybe there was something that happened between them that night 4 months prior.
I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine.
Or the husband just suspected maybe he's super jealous.
Maybe. I don't know. But basically, when it comes down to it, it's a lot of circumstantial evidence and no real witnesses. So what ended up happening? A jury convicted Louis Montesi of voluntary manslaughter, which he then appealed. So this appeal went up to the Tennessee Supreme Court. That was then overturned due to the circumstantial evidence that I named. So the court then remanded the case for a new trial, where Louis Montesi was then found guilty again, but this time of involuntary manslaughter. However, this conviction was also overturned. So he either knew somebody, he had some great lawyers, I don't know. Also, I don't know the difference. I need to look that up. I don't know the difference between voluntary and involuntary manslaughter.
I think one is an accident. Accidentally killed somebody.
I have to look all that up because I get confused about first degree, second degree. Because that's
Voluntary manslaughter is you knew what you were doing. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you were. If it was involuntary, maybe it's like you hit somebody with your car.
But that's what's the difference between that and then second degree murder.
I didn't go to. Didn't take criminal law.
I'm gonna do some further research on this.
If you guys know, let us know. Educate us. So yeah, the Montesis. You know, locally in the Memphis area.
If they are connected to this family, then maybe they were inspired by...
Maybe that's how they got into law.
Yeah, what great lawyers he had. I have no idea. That's just
this case is confusing, really, because there's no hard evidence. And we are so used to...
DNA
clearing everything. And I wonder, since this case... Is it cold? Is it still open?
Because
no one's been officially.
I mean, they found him guilty, but they overturned it. So are they still looking for somebody else? Is there any other problem?
Probably not.
I wouldn't think
but
so.
But I wonder if they still have the evidence from there. Because if they had the skin cells under her nails, could be tested these days and determine right away if it's her husband's or not. That'd be interesting. I doubt they'll go back in time, you know, look at that case from that perspective. They got enough current cases going on. But, and, you know, the fact that the oddity thing is, you know, calling of Vicky. Vicky said that Evelyn yelled out to her.
That is really
come,
weird.
Like, why wouldn't she yell out to her husband
right, to
come help?
If it was a robber or an intruder... Why would you call out to your 16-year-old daughter to help you?
And
that doesn't make any sense.
Vicky knew Donald Bersicola because she had met them.
Right,
he'd been at their earlier. House. If she saw, but she didn't see anything though.
That's the other thing. The Commercial Appeal article I read, Montesi said the intruder was wearing a face stocking. So that's another new element. So Montesi's saying, this guy's got a stocking on. I don't know who it is. But then he's like, no, it's Donald Bersicola. So he just keeps changing his mind.
Yeah, I think he said he recognized his voice.
Okay.
So, but yeah, just a lot of he said, she said.
Yeah.
And throughout this whole case. So ultimately, no one is put in prison permanently for the murder of Evelyn Montesi.
Yeah. And when I first looked into this, I immediately am like, oh, this is cut and dry. Like, her husband did it. And I still think that he did it. But I am bothered by the circumstantial evidence. I think that it would be so hard to be on a jury back then. Back any time there was a crime committed before DNA. I feel like if you don't have a witness or if you don't have a confession, how can you 100% know this person's guilty, and how can you live with that choice to convict them or not, you know, if you don't 100% know, which I know DNA has got its own problems too. It's not like a perfect solution to everything, but I think there's some reasonable doubt. I still think he did it, but I think there was some reasonable doubt there.
Yeah. Questions that I still have are, it's supposed to be in a robbery. And yeah, they said the house was disheveled in it, but I saw nothing in any of the reports that,
what was stolen?
What allegedly was taken?
Right.
That didn't.
How did he get the wound on the back of his head?
How do you do that to yourself?
Which, I mean, I guess he did get it. If he was fighting with her, maybe she gave it to him.
Or maybe he fell.
Yeah.
If it was a tumble, maybe he, you know, fell backwards or something.
I don't know.
The gun.
Right. Where's the gun?
If he's the one who shot her and everything happened so fast, you know, with him going to the neighbor and all that jazz, just seems, and the police never found and the murder weapon, seems like it's not
strange.
At the house.
Yeah,
it's so that kind of gives you reasonable doubt.
Yeah. Do you think he did it though?
I don't know.
No,
I'm not as strongly convinced. Maybe
I think he did it, but I still feel like I think that's easy to say sitting from my chair decades later. think if I had been on a jury in the 60s presented with this, I would have had a lot more doubts about it.
I don't see a strong motive for the Donald guy.
I don't either.
Unless, you know, there's stuff we just don't know. Well, obviously there's stuff we don't know about, but.
I would love to know what happened to him exactly, Donald Bersicola. Like, where he
was. I looked him up. He's still alive. Lives in Ohio, I believe.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm sure this affected his life in not a great way after the fact. It didn't help Louis Montesi's. His life was kind of a hot mess after all these trials and acquittals. He went on to have three more failed marriages. None of them lasted very long. One of them was only 56 days and ended in divorce. And his last marriage lasted less than 2 years. And it sounded very tumultuous. You found some of the newspaper articles about that.
Article from, I guess it was his last wife. He was basically accusing her of being a money-grabbing person. Mm-hmm. But she was saying that he was abusive. He was drank alcohol. He was drunk all the time, that he choked her, that he basically told her that she was going to end up like Evelyn if she didn't watch out.
Oh, gosh.
Definitely sounds like he had a violent temper. Right. So that doesn't bode well in terms of my opinion of him. Right. But I still don't know if he did it.
Yeah. I think that, you know, after all the trials and everything, Dad told us that it definitely hurt their business, their grocery store business, that a lot of local people would boycott going to the grocery stores because they were like, oh.
Don't be associated with the murder.
Yeah. So that's, I don't know, it's kind of just some interesting Memphis lore.
Didn't he come to the
Yeah, our dad had a shop. He had a business in Memphis. And Dad said that. Right. Dad said that years after the murder, Louis Montesi came in to ask for something to be made, or I don't know what it was exactly. It was some little thing. And that when he left, our great-grandmother was like, do you know who that was? Like, that was Louis Montesi. He killed his wife. So he was
opinion.
Right. He was well-known around town, and people just, you know, assumed he was guilty. So interesting little Memphis history.
Interesting case. I'd never heard of it before.
Do you think Montesi was a murderer? You should let us know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's about it for this case.
We're doing a little short one. We had a long podcast the last time, so
doing a little. Sometimes the ones that are solved, even though this is not really solved, are shorter because there's an ending. But we want to thank everybody for following us on our social media, on Facebook, Instagram, Riverside Homicide, leaving us reviews, giving us case suggestions. We actually think we have three or four in the hopper that are all from you. Mm-hmm. And so we're investigating and looking into those. And so we look forward to bringing those to you. We're trying to do once a month and within the first 15 days of each month. That's what we're committing to at this point.
Yeah, I think we can hold to that. But yeah, we super appreciate any suggestions, any little tidbits. Those definitely, and the reviews. We love to read the reviews. They help us to get better and to continue growing and learning and changing and improving how we're doing this podcast. So let us know if you know how to play bridge. I do want to know that. we really appreciate it. We thank you again, and join us next time.